From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
California's groundbreaking legislation, Assembly Bill 32, or AB 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, created a cap-and-trade program to reverse greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. Has it worked? And what happens to cap-and-trade after 2020? We'll ask. Ross Brown, expert in air quality, energy, and climate change with California's Legislative Analyst Office, as well as two veteran Capitol observers, John Howard, editor of California Weekly, and Dan Walters, the popular columnist with the Sacramento Bee. Cap-and-trade 2.0. What changes? We'll also hear from Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe, and Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Is California's cap-and-trade program meeting the state's goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 2020? That's the subject of a report by our guest, Ross Brown, with the Legislative Analyst Office. He's an expert in air quality, energy, and climate change. Welcome. So, cap-and-trade is one strategy that California has kind of adopted to meet its greenhouse gas emission goals by 2020. How does it differ from the more traditional regulatory approach?
Under more traditional approaches, a regulator will tell a company or a polluter that they need to install a particular type of technology, or all polluters need to meet some sort of particular emission standard. Cap and trade is...
And if they don't, they ding them, right? They fine them or
something. Exactly, okay. Exactly. And cap and trade is more is what's called a market-based mechanism. And so the idea is to establish a price or a cost for a unit of emission and to encourage companies to reduce their emissions based on that price and based on that cost. And the idea is to encourage companies to identify the least costly emission
and
reduction.
And be cost-effective, right? So say, hit the target, B, we don't care how you do it, just hit the target.
Exactly, exactly. And it gives that flexibility to companies to achieve that.
You know, about 30%, what I'm reading in your report, about 30% of the greenhouse gas emission reductions come from the cap and trade program. How much of the greenhouse gas emissions, though, are capped? You don't cap all of them. How much do you cap? How much is uncapped? And can you give us some examples?
About 85% of the state's emissions are subject to the cap and trade program. Those include things such as transportation fuels like gasoline.
That's a new addition.
Exactly. Electricity generation from power plants. Various industrial sources, such as cement manufacturing and oil refineries. Some of the uncapped sources are things like methane emissions from landfills or from dairy farms, from manure on dairy farms.
Agriculture.
Exactly.
There's a big exemption from there.
Exactly.
That's a little surprising probably to some. How does the ARB, the Air Resources Board, implement the cap-and-trade program? How do they go about enforcing it?
So the first step is to establish the cap, what the overall level of emissions allowed will be. And to establish that cap, they issue a limited number of allowances. And each allowance is essentially a permit to emit one unit of emissions.
Okay.
And businesses...
Which is one ton of carbon dioxide.
That's exactly
right. That's for one allowance.
That's exactly right. And so for companies that are emitting, they need to obtain one allowance for each unit of emissions. And companies can buy and sell and trade those allowances.
So if I'm pretty efficient here in terms of emissions, I could use those, the ones allocated to me, to then sell them to someone who's having a problem.
Exactly. And again, back to that idea of cost effectiveness. If it's more costly for one company to reduce their emissions and cheaper for another, then in theory, the cheaper company will reduce its emissions.
Yeah, so you're creating a market. It's
exactly.
A market-based approach.
Exactly.
Using efficiencies. You know, AB 32, which kind of started all this a few years ago, established these greenhouse gas emission targets by 2020. What happens, though, to these greenhouse gas emission goals and the cap and trade program after 2020?
Well, I think the most important point here is that there's quite a bit of uncertainty about sort of the legality going forward and what's in AB 32. I'll take the question in two parts. One is just the overall limit on emissions, and our reading of the law is that that cap that's established for 2020 will remain beyond 2020.
Which is the 1990 levels.
Exactly.
Okay, so
exactly.
They're supposed to reduce it, just to be clear, they're supposed to reduce greenhouse gas emission levels to 1990 levels by 2020.
Exactly. Okay. And so that cap on overall emissions will and that limit will remain beyond that. Not any lower, not go away. as far as the cap and trade program.
This is as a point, though, not any lower, you say, but the governor and others want it to go lower.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And so that's part of the policy discussions going on right now, exactly. And as far as using the cap and trade program as a tool to achieve those limits, there's also uncertainty regarding that. But our view is that the legislature would likely need to reapprove that in order for it to extend beyond 2020.
Okay. So some of these carbon allowances are given away and some are auctioned. How is that decided, and what's the split between those that are given away and those that are auctioned?
So the ARB determines how many are given away and how many are auctioned. One of the key determining factors is for giving the allowances away, they look at companies that are at risk of potentially moving out of state if they have to pay the higher prices for the allowances and have to purchase the allowances. And so they'll make a determination of giving some allowances away to those companies that are at risk. For the remaining allowances, they're typically auctioned off. And roughly half of the allowances are auctioned off and the other half are given away.
Yeah, and the one issue about giving away some of these allowances is you're concerned about what's called leakage. Can you mention just that whole point about leakage?
Exactly. And so leakage is sort of that issue that I was just touching on, which is certain companies, if they have to pay for the allowances, then there's a concern that they won't be as competitive with other companies that are out of state. And so some of the economic activity and even some of the emissions associated with producing those types of products will be pushed out of state. And so the idea is to try and limit that type of
leakage. We don't make the situation worse. Well, just very quickly, how much revenue does cap and trade generate, and what's the money used for?
About $2 billion a year currently, and the money has to be spent on greenhouse gas emission reductions by law. The money is used on a variety of different things, including the state's high-speed rail project, transit services, rebates for electric vehicles, and a variety of other things.
Okay, well, thanks for providing that overview of California's cap and trade program. Up next, so what can be done to improve the cap and trade program? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Ross Brown, the LAO's expert on air quality, energy, and climate change about the state's cap and trade program. So you've suggested that spending a substantial amount of auction revenue on greenhouse gas emissions in the capped sector may not be a good idea. Why is that?
It's because there are some complicated and perhaps sort of unexpected consequences associated with spending on those types of activities. And it gets at sort of the fundamental issue of the cap or the number of allowances that are issued is really the primary factor determining your overall level of emissions. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the number of allowances is limiting emissions, then if the state spends to encourage an emission reduction from one particular type of company or source, then in many cases that might simply free up an allowance to be used by another company that otherwise would have reduced their emissions, but now they have their allowance
net zero
to them. So exactly, in the end, there may not be any net change in overall emissions.
Right now, though, you were talking earlier about cap and trade money can only be spent on greenhouse gas emission reductions. What are the implications of that, you know, limiting to how you can spend that money?
Well, one is just the interactions that we just talked about and perhaps no net effect on emissions. There are also implications about whether or not the state would be spending on the most cost-effective reductions. Another important implication is that there's limited flexibility for the state to use the revenue in ways that achieve other goals. For example, it can't use the revenue to provide rebates or tax offsets to help offset some of the costs that businesses or households might be incurring as a result of operating the program.
I mean, the whole idea behind cap and trade was not as a revenue generator. The idea was supposed to be to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, is my understanding.
Exactly, exactly, and provide that incentive, and so you can keep that incentive in place and perhaps use the revenue to help offset some of those costs rather than keeping it for the
state. There's been this discussion, was in your report, about this uncertainty around cap and trade after 2020 because of how AB 32 was written. What are the implications of that uncertainty?
Well, for private businesses, there's some uncertainty about what types of investments they should be making, particularly in types of activities that might have more long-run effects on emissions. And so if they don't know whether the program's going to be in place, they don't know whether it's a good idea to invest in a particular type of
technology. So we've invested to get down to 1990 levels. Do we want to invest, you know, to reduce it even more? We're not sure because we're not sure it's going to be extended.
Exactly.
Or the amount lowered, even though, you know, there's executive orders to that effect, but governors change and executive orders can change.
That's right.
So, yeah, I think businesses like certainty.
Exactly.
Right? Predictability, because they're trying to budget for that.
Exactly.
What about the different scenarios? You were talking about in your report about different scenarios to promote the goals of AB 32. One of the ones you talk about is basically leaving the legal framework unchanged. but require that cap and trade revenue be spent specifically on greenhouse gas emission reductions. What are the new strategies that could be used under that scenario?
Well, some of the ways that we think about under the current framework and the current restrictions on the use of the funds and ways to spend it in a way that achieve various goals are, if the goal is ultimately to reduce more greenhouse gas reductions beyond what the cap establishes, then maybe one way to think about it is to spend on sources, those sources that are outside of the cap sector, such as agriculture that we were talking about before.
So put a little more money to that. And so when you're talking about the ag sector, for example, I would guess you're talking about things like diesel tractors. Perhaps pumps, diesel pumps, these things of that nature?
Not necessarily. It's more, I think, the emissions associated. Take a dairy farm, for example, mm-hmm. and the manure associated with that dairy farm that leaks methane, and those are greenhouse gases. And so those are emissions that aren't subject to the typical cap and trade program. And so investing in things that reduce those types of emissions might have an overall net effect.
And we can't put a cattle converter on a cow, so we've got to figure out how we're going to do that. The other option you were talking about in your report, this is the second option, was to reauthorize the cap and trade program with a two-thirds vote. I want you to talk about that. Why two-thirds? And then completely remove the requirement of cap and trade money being spent exclusively on greenhouse gas emission reductions. What are the implications of that approach if that was taken?
Well, it gets back at the issue of flexibility. And again, the goal of the program is not necessarily to raise revenue. It's provide an incentive for greenhouse gas emission reductions. And so by removing that requirement, the state would have greater flexibility to use any money that does come in on rebates or tax reductions to, again, help offset some of the costs, or it could fund whatever its other highest priorities are.
It's kind of like calling it what it is. I mean, it is a revenue generator. But why two-thirds? You know, it was passed with a majority vote. You're suggesting maybe two-thirds might be an option to consider. Why two-thirds?
Because a two-thirds vote is really needed to remove that requirement that the money be spent on greenhouse gas emission
reductions. Because taxes have to be by a two-thirds vote. And if it's just a regulatory fee, apparently it just has to be a majority vote.
Exactly. The way that the AB 32 program was originally authorized was with a majority vote. And so that's what establishes that restriction.
So I think what I got from that in your report is better to be safe than sorry. Well, I want to thank Ross Brown from the Legislative Analyst's Office for giving us some options on how to improve the state's cap and trade program. Up next, what are the politics of cap and trade? We're going to discuss that with two veteran political observers, Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee and John Howard from Capital Weekly. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Governor Brown has made addressing climate change a key goal of his administration. Moving forward, the question is whether the governor is going to change his strategies to achieve that goal. We have two veteran Capital observers to answer that and other questions. John Howard is the editor of Capital Weekly. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
And Dan Walters is the Sacramento Bee's well-read political columnist. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Mark.
So, John, let me start with you. Legislature rejected a major piece of the governor's proposed climate change package last year, but the governor wasn't deterred. He said that his, quote, zeal has been intensified to a maximum degree, unquote. And the ARB recently required a 10% cut in the carbon intensity of transportation fuels by 2020, promoting such things as natural gas, biodiesel, electricity, other things. Is this an indication that the governor is maybe changing his strategy to focusing more on regulations rather than new laws?
Well, I've got to think he's going to do both. There's no reason at all to think that he's going to stop wanting to do regulations, not do executive orders as it relates to this kind of a topic. And I think he'll continue to do that. Clearly, he wants to get legislation out of the legislature. That's better than having executive orders that can be rolled back later. And I think given that we're at this time of year, we're talking about the budget now, everything is negotiable. The budget is a political document much more than it's a checkbook document. So I got to think some of this will show up in the budget.
Regulations or legislation?
Well, I think, as John says, it'll probably be both, but he has a real problem with the legislation. As we know, there's now a block of Democrats in the Assembly, and maybe even one merging in the Senate, of so-called moderate Democrats, Mod Squad. There's several names attached to them. Some of them are not printable in a family setting. And they hold sway. They are the balance of power on these kinds of business-related issues. And when you talk about cutting oil in transportation by 50%, that's a multi-billion dollar business issue. And the oil industry takes umbrage at that, and they will fight back, and they've been so successful so far. He can try to do it through other venues, but as John says, it doesn't have the permanency of law. He's talks about, well, we're going to put a bunch of money into improving mass transit, and that will have, but that's a kind of an indirect carrot rather than a stick. And he wants a stick. He wants something in law that says you cut petroleum use in automotive travel by 50% by 2030. I don't know if it's even technically possible to do so, but that's what he wants. In fact, we're actually going the other way these days. The gasoline consumption has been rising, not declining, as the price has fallen. So I think he's kind of up against the wall. He's very unhappy with that. I mean, he's mad. I mean, Jerry doesn't like to lose, and he's very frustrated, and he's mad about it. And he's mad that he was just rolling along, and suddenly he hits this roadblock.
Well, what about that 50% reduction in terms of the state budget, where the governor's allocating $1 billion to kind of move in that direction? So in other words, not getting it in terms of legislation, but getting it in terms of the state budget. Does it make it any more palatable to the legislature?
It might make it more palatable, but it's chicken feet, frankly.
That's the first time I've heard $1 billion referred to as chicken feet.
Well, in Sacramento, $1 billion is chicken feet, unfortunately. Or a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon it adds up to real money, somebody once said. No, it is chicken feet. It's trying to get a carrot out there to trying to make it more attractive for people to use transit rather than their cars. But it's a hard slog. $1 billion isn't very much money when you're really talking about that. And it's second or third choice. You know, it's not really his first choice. Yeah. He wants a law that says you got to do it, and it's going to be very difficult.
Well, let's talk about that, John. I want to ask you a question though. You know, AB 32 is supposed to basically sunset in 2020 in a way. I mean, there's nothing past that. Do you think the legislature is going to try to re-up it with either a simple majority or a two-thirds vote? What's going to happen with AB 32 going forward?
I don't see AB 32 going away. I guess a simple majority vote would be easier than a two-thirds vote, but there are lots of other ways to keep this process going. Executive orders are one of them. We're going to have a new governor here in a couple of years. Gavin Newsom has already, hit
his wagon. You're already anointing him as the governor?
Yeah. Maybe Gavin Newsom.
Right.
But he, for one of the candidates, has already hitched his political wagon to global warming as a problem and dealing with climate change. I don't see AB 32 going away. I think the fight is going to be over the money. One thing that never materialized, I think, with the cap and trade process is the level of fund, the dollars that were involved. They were estimating at the beginning of the auction $12 billion to $45 billion as being these revenue, the possibilities of money coming in. And in fact, the last numbers I saw were $3.5 billion, not that much. And the ceiling price is still way up. The floor price is still, I think, about 12 bucks. It's shy of $13 a credit. And that's not where people thought it would be by now.
I think you also have to remember that the whole idea of the cap and trade fees is still under court. In a battle in court, the business community has filed suit saying it's an illegal tax. And if and when it expires in 2020, that's going to be one of those issues. Is it in fact a tax? Is it not a tax? I mean, the state is in court saying, well, no, it really wasn't meant to raise revenues. At the same time, they're planning on all those revenues to build a bullet train. So, I mean, there's a lot of back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I personally think that once Jerry Brown leaves office, a lot of the steam goes out of it.
I guess we're going to talk about the political climate around cap and trade when we come back. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee and John Howard from Capital Weekly about the politics surrounding the state's cap and trade program. So, Dan, I want to ask you about the potential political fissures in the Democratic Party. I mean, you've got more liberal people from the coast versus more moderate inland Democrats. You've got the richer communities versus the poorer communities. You've got the majority Hispanic or black districts possibly against competing within the environmental groups on the Democratic Party. What does all this mean for cap and trade?
I think, well, it means a lot for cap and trade because the ability to actually get something in law, either a a fuel mandate or even the renewal of AB 32 in 2020 will depend on the makeup of the legislature. And the business community has been very, very adept in recent years at using the top two primary system, particularly at getting business-friendly Democrats in the legislature. Essentially, the more Democrats you have, the less unity they have. There's more variation,
and sub-groups,
so they're not marching. Yeah, you get sub-factions, and they're not marching all in lockstep. And the business community has cultivated these Democrats very successfully. And if there's going to be some vast new environmental program like a fuel mandate, a reduction mandate, or even possibly the renewal of AB 32 in 2020, the, for lack of a better phrase, the left wing of the party, of the Democratic Party, is going to have to do a better job. It's the price they pay for having bigger numbers is to not have everybody on the reservation.
Yeah, I want to ask you, John, about the mods, and Dan was talking about that earlier. These are the pro-business Democrats, particularly in the Assembly, a lot of them from the San Joaquin Valley. Last year, they basically killed the governor's goal of that 50% reduction in fuel use by 2030. What do you think they're going to be doing going forward? What is going to be their target? Is it legislation? Is it regulation? How are the mods going to play in this area?
Well, I think in one respect, they'll be fighting legislation. I think it's no accident that the two major figures from the Valley, Henry Perea and Michael Rubio, left their positions and both went to work directly or indirectly for the petroleum industry. It's a huge issue in the Valley. Air pollution is a big issue down there.
Well, Henry Perea left to work for Pharma, which is a lobby group for the pharmaceutical companies.
Yes, he'd been very active, though, in the transportation fuels piece.
But when he was in the Assembly, yes, he was yes, he was the leader of the mods.
And it just seems to me there's an environmental justice issue in the Valley as well. Clean air is a big deal down there. It's less important on the coast. There, you talked about a fissure between coastal Democrats and inland Democrats. I think it's very clear that it's there. We just saw that recently in the Coastal Commission issue with their executive director being ousted by the panel. And the people that are most vocal about that are coastal property owners, coastal environmentalists, not the Inland Valley folks. It's clean air for them. So I think it's a big issue for them.
But Tim, let me ask you this. Statewide, diesel freight emits 45% of the smog-forming pollution. Last summer, Governor Brown issued an executive order directing state agencies to establish, quote, clear targets to transition California's freight system to a zero-emission technology. Wouldn't that require a pretty radical transformation of California's trucking industry?
Well, no, it would require a radical transformation of California's trucking industry and an incalculable cost, I might add. But what do you do about trucks from other states? I mean, we get a tremendous number of trucks
stopping at the border and unload, and
either coming here to get stuff or bringing stuff here. How are you going to do this? I mean, California can't be an island unto itself, even though it's named after a mythical island in medieval literature. It can't really be an island unto itself. At some point, it has to deal with these things in a realistic way. I think it's easy for the governor to send out an order without any force of law to say, well, we ought to work towards that. And he can cross that off his list. He said, well, I've taken care of that. But actually doing it and actually implementing it would be, if not impossible, it's so extraordinarily difficult, it's hard to conceive of it happening.
Yeah. So let me ask you about rooftop solar. It's very popular. We're seeing a lot of that in the Valley. There's this issue of something called net metering. And the PUC, Public Utilities Commission, is holding hearings to change the way these solar panel users are reimbursed for the power they generate. So what's going on there, and what do you think is the likely outcome?
Well, net metering is popular. It's in 45 states, at least. The issue is not necessarily net metering itself, but the level of reimbursement. And right now, as I understand it, in California, the level of reimbursement basically is the full cost of that power. And the utilities say that's not fair. The people getting reimbursed didn't put in the conduits. They didn't put in the infrastructure to do that.
Transmission lines and all the rest,
I don't think it's going away, though. I think solar energy, alternative energy, is here to stay in some fashion or another. And I think net metering is, too. The reimbursement rate is the fight.
Another reason why the PUC is probably going to be in the news going forward.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, I want to thank our guests, Capital Weekly's John Howard and the Sacramento Bee's political columnist Dan Walters, for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by going onto our website at maddieandsoup.org. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter. This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us. The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org. Up next, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee, and chair of the political science department at UC Merced, Professor Nate Monroe. They'll discuss the implications of cap and trade for the Valley.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. Is cap and trade good or bad for the Valley? We're going to ask Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Mark.
Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
And the Tony Coelho Chair of Public Policy at UC Merced, Professor Nate Monroe. Welcome, Nate.
Glad to be here, as always. Thanks, Mark.
Nate, let me start with you first. Let's start this off kind of as a philosophical discussion about how the cap and trade program is really set up. It's set up as a market-based approach to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Instead of using the more traditional, you know, command and control method of regulation where the government tells you what you have to do, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on cap and trade's market-based approach.
Well, I mean, I think in theory, right, it's the approach that is, you know, has the promise of reducing overall emissions by the most efficient means possible, right? So, you know, as compared to sort of a pure command and control situation where you're just forcing, you know, various sorts of producers to cap their emissions at a certain level, regardless of sort of what the cost of that is to the business, right? You create a circumstance where companies can sort of decide just how valuable it is for them to pollute, and they can either sort of buy or sell credits in a way that allows them to sort of at least, I think, reduce the impact on business while simultaneously, you know, overall reducing emissions. But, the problem, of course, with a lot of market-based approaches is that they don't always sort of operate efficiently as the market promises. And I think cap and trade's one that when it has been tried, has worked better than some markets, but it's not without its flaws.
Yeah, I would think that most businesses are not saying, hey, please, government, regulate us. But if they're going to be regulated, this market-based approach allows them some flexibility to find the most cost-effective way to deal with the issue. So I guess it's better maybe than the traditional method. But anyway, I want to go on to Paul Hurley. I want to ask you a question about, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and what falls and what doesn't fall under this system. One of the things that doesn't fall under the cap-and-trade program is agriculture. So the question is, should emissions from agriculture be uncapped, or should they be part of the cap and trade program?
Well, I think probably eventually they should be capped. But, you know, agriculture is sort of far down on the list already of businesses that are subject to this program. As I understand it, so far it's only the very largest greenhouse gas emitters in the state. And this only this year they started with gasoline producers, and it's far down from there. I think you're probably a few years away from including agriculture in this program. But why not? If agriculture is contributing to an increase in greenhouse gas emissions, they're a business like any other, and I'm sure they can deal with it. Agriculture is actually fairly, I shouldn't say nimble, but sort of flexible in adjusting to things when they're imposed on them. They don't like it, but they do make the adjustments.
Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bee, what are your thoughts on this? Should ag be part of the cap and trade program?
Well, I'm going to put on my farmer overalls, and I'm going to tell you I'm already part of the program. I have to buy fuel for my farm. I got to buy diesel for my trucks. I'm paying the cap and fee extra pennies on that. So don't say I'm not part of the program. I'm kind of in. My toe is dipped into it.
Okay.
Other comment would be, you know, we're a powerful group. And when it came to, you know, what we think of as air pollution, we were the last industry brought under the air pollution tent. So we would expect that we're going to be one of the very last groups that are ever brought in into the cap and trade game as well. And we're going to use all our lobbyists, and we're going to put the red, white, and blue up there, and we're going to talk about how we feed the world. And, yeah, someday we'll be part of cap and trade, but that's a long ways down the road.
Well, actually, farmers might be able to actually benefit from cap and trade, Bill, can't they, using biogas digesters and those kinds of things, actually can make some money with this program?
Okay, so biogas digesters, everybody brings that up, and you know what? I think it's just, it's like a symbol. It's like what solar panels were in 1975. I can remember down south of Fresno, they did one of these on a big farm. They talked about converting all the energy and everything, and you know what? It was on a dairy, and I know that that group went bankrupt. I mean, so I haven't seen yet that those things pencil in any way.
Well, it seems
and
like
Mark, and again, everybody talks about how, you know, they're going this way and they're doing it. It's real slow. There are actually very few of them around.
And Mark, let me jump in here a second.
Sure, Nate.
So one of the questions we get asked all the time, right, as part of the Maddie report is, you know, how does this affect the Valley, right? So putting everything in context. And one of the things that I think we got to think about, it's hard to think about cap and trade at this moment in time, sort of in a vacuum when we think about it in the context of agriculture. So certainly someday ag may be in, and I think, you know, as Paul said, you know, why not? But the why not, I suppose, is in the context of right now is, think about all the other regulatory things that ag is facing and has faced over the last few years. And from the perspective of the Valley that sort of is so intimately tied to the fortune of ag, given the problems with water that they're facing, given the problems with other sort of with the some of the threat faced with the increase in minimum wage, I think cap and trade, you know, sort of putting extra burden on them right now would be, you know, I think overburdensome all at once if ag were to be brought into this and sort of capped at this moment, I think.
Yeah, too much too
soon.
So,
Mark, can I jump in on this?
Sure, Bill, go ahead.
Because, but when they talk about how it affects the Valley, so about 2 years into cap and trade, right, we have all these professors, and probably one or more of them was on the payroll for CARB, so I don't know how objective they are. But they talk about cap and trade, no drag on the economy. Look, California's economy is flourishing. That's the headline. Well, you got to dig a little deeper. And if you dig a little deeper, would you say the Valley's economy is flourishing? And I haven't seen any report that, you know, separates eight counties and says, what has the effect of cap and trade been? We know that if you got a lot of money in your pocket, you know, you can afford to pay higher fuel costs. When you're rich, you can afford to deal with regulation. We don't know what the effect has been on the economy here.
You know, I want to ask Paul, I want to bring the conversation back to whether or not farmers can actually benefit from cap and trade. I mean, Paul, what about the ability to diversify ag income by selling electricity with these biogas digesters? I understand that there aren't a lot out there, but if this program ramps up, couldn't that be another source of revenue for farmers?
I don't think the biogas digesters have been in specifically biogas digesters, but I don't think they've been the failure that Bill has said. I know that dairy farm in Lindsay is still going strong, and it's still converting methane gas and using some of that energy. I'm not sure they're selling it back to the grid, but it is being used. And there is a company in Visalia that is doing very well in using biofuels. So there's still some, there's some success story there. I think agriculture can benefit, and you can see this already, the way farms are taking advantage of solar energy. Throughout the Valley, you're seeing farms installing sort of mini solar farms, and they're doing that not only to take advantage of their land and, of course, the climate and to reduce their energy costs, but also to get their foot in the door in things like cap and trade. Now, I don't know if cap and trade really is going to apply to solar, but you already see agriculture going there.
It was interesting. I saw an article recently that's saying that California maybe has too much solar, you know, from a situation where we didn't know if we would have enough, and now we're talking about having too much. Professor Monroe, Nate, let me ask you this question about revenue that's derived from cap and trade. It's cranking out a lot of money. It's generated about, what, $3.5 billion since 2012. Is that good or bad for the Valley? Is the Valley benefiting from that revenue? Are they spending it here in the Valley?
Well, I think, like many things, some but not much, right? I mean, so if you look at, what those things are that affordable housing, sustainable communities, inner city rail capital projects, low carbon transit operations, HSR. So, I mean, these aren't things.
HSR is high speed rail, and about 25%. Of cap and trade is going to high-speed rail. So there's some money there.
There's some money there, but I mean, it depends on when you mean benefiting, right? I mean, we haven't exactly seen that money pour in yet, right? When we're talking about high-speed rail, and that plan continues to change. And so, I think down the road, if that money does come to high-speed rail and that money is spent sort of in the Valley for high speed rail, right? That those contracts go and those sort of the communities that are surrounding that construction project benefit. And sure, but I mean, at this moment, right, as with many things, I don't think there's a ton of money coming in from cap and trade for high speed for to the Valley. That could change some in the future, but I don't see it being sort of a windfall.
Well, as they ramp, go ahead, Paul.
Mark, I agree with Nate. If money's coming into the Valley from this, it's in a trickle. And it's probably mainly through high-speed rail. And even that is just the beginning. But there is some potential there. You see public transportation fleets and even maybe some private ones that could be converted to low-emission fuels. And you're already seeing this happen in school districts and in municipalities. And so there is some potential there for this program to benefit the Valley. I don't see anything on affordable housing at this point in the Valley anyway. And, of course, inner-city rail capital projects, that's just not going to apply here.
Well, Bill, there is that 25%. I don't want to keep harping on high-speed rail, but that's about $500 to $600 million a year as high-speed rail gets moving, and that's the first operating segment is in the Valley. So isn't cap and trade – could you make the argument?
Well, I can tell you basically that's the attitude from Sacramento. The Valley's getting high-speed rail, they ought to be grateful for that, and basically that's that. I mean, think back, I think it was 6-9 months ago, Henry T. Perea, before he left Sacramento, he compiled up where the cap-and-trade money was going. And very little of it was going to the Valley. And, this has been one of the big objections all along, and it's a continual fight. And the irony is you can bet that coastal communities are going to get a ton of this cap and trade money.
Well, Bill, let me ask you this. Is that the reason for that? Because the money, cap and trade money, can only be spent on greenhouse gas emissions, and that's a little different than from the issue of air quality. Is that the problem?
You nailed it. Absolutely. I mean, I talked with the people at the Air Pollution Control Board before I went on the show, and they're like, "Hey, that's not our thing. You need to call CARB."
CARB is the California Air Resources Board. For those who don't use acronyms. But so what do you think needs to be – perhaps the legislature should go back and loosen up the cap-and-trade program a little bit so money could be spent on other things like improving air quality that may benefit the Valley? Is that something you'd like to say?
That's way beyond me. I hope somebody else wants to jump in on that one.
So I'm going to ask Professor Monroe. He's the political scientist. Put him on the spot here. Do you think that's something that could happen or are the politics just not – lined up correctly to kind of expand cap and trade to go beyond greenhouse gas emissions and to use that money? It never was supposed to be established really as a revenue source, but it is. The question is, use that money for other things that might be more important to the state and to regions like the Valley?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no. I actually do think the politics might line up. I don't know if that means today, but I think that and thinking a little more macro sense, there's just such strong limits on the way that revenues can be raised in general, and ever more creative ways to find sort of funds to be able to expand to, I think, more general purposes. That I do think that, it's going to cap and trade, not only the sort of cap and trade itself on greenhouse, but and the way those funds are eventually used, but also cap and trade concept on new kinds of pollution and other kinds of relevant sort of regulatory areas, almost certainly will be expanded, I think, in the next couple of decades to try to bring in more revenue and at least attempt to solve other kinds of regulatory problems with market-based solutions.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next segment. And we're also going to be talking about reducing fossil fuels, gasoline and diesel in the Valley. Is that going to have good or bad consequences? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking to UC political science professor Nate Monroe, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, and Bill McEwen, the current editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee, about what the state is doing along the lines of greenhouse gas reductions, et cetera, and how it's going to impact us here in the Valley. So, Bill, I want to ask you this first question, this segment. The legislature rejected the governor's attempt to enact a 50% reduction in fossil fuel use by 2020. But the ARB, we were talking about earlier, has passed a new rule that will require at least a 10% cut in the carbon intensity of transportation fuels by 2020. That's a mouthful. Promoting the use of more natural gas, biodiesel, electricity, and other less polluting fuels. So, question, what are the implications for the Valley?
Well, the implications for the Valley are pretty simple. I mean, the Valley needs to go electric. And the Air Board has stated that the Valley Air Board has said the only way we can meet these new federal standards, and by the way, we've never reached the standards that we had in the past, let alone these extremely stringent future standards, is basically we have to be an all-electric Valley. And so I see that happening, and certainly, all the focus is on the Tesla 3, right, and all the people that put a $1,000 deposit to have this car that doesn't even exist. Yeah. But the reality is that Detroit is really up in its game on the electric car, and General Motors and Ford, and they're going to have new nice models out, as well as Nissan will, the updated Leaf. Those will be out before the Tesla 3 is ever out. Yep. So we'll see if people buy into that. And, of course, we need the supporting infrastructure. If we're going to put people in electric cars, they got to be able to recharge their cars very conveniently. I think the one big hole in this whole ARB estimate, though, is they're talking about getting people to drive less.
Yeah, and I want to ask.
That's not happening. That is a total pipe dream, and they can talk about mass transit all they want. And mass transit, in Sacramento, that fewer people are using the light rail system there, and not just a couple fewer people. I mean, I think they're down 7 or 8%.
Well, I want to ask Paul
over last year.
I want to ask Paul this. One of the things that the ARB offers, you saw almost a dare there, isn't that, Bill? They offer this what they call a simple path to get to this level. One of the points is reducing the growth in vehicle miles traveled by 4%. In other words, 1.5 miles a day. Paul, is that impossible here in the Valley?
Absolutely. That's just the way it's going to happen. I see some hope in some programs that maybe reduce that. For instance, here in Visalia, they started something called the V Line. It's a bus that goes from Visalia to Fresno State, Fresno Airport, and Fresno downtown and back. It makes 6 loops a day. Apparently, ridership on that is like booming. It started out with like 400 people a month in December. Now it's up to 1,500 a month. That kind of stuff is going to catch on if it is. If it's promoted and fed properly. But to get down to a mile and a half a day vehicle mile traveled, that's just not going to fly around here. Not going to work. And I agree with Bill about there's no infrastructure here for an electric community. They can't even build enough infrastructure in the Bay Area to support the electric cars they already have there. I don't see how it happens in the Valley.
Well, let me ask you, Professor Monroe, this. You know, the governor's proposing spending a third of the cap and trade funds, about $1 billion, on public transit, promoting electric vehicles and other programs with the explicit goal of reducing oil use by 50% by 2030. Is that going to work here in the Valley? Public transit, electric vehicles, that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, it's not going to, you know, it depends on how we define what work means, right? I mean, it's not going to work in the sense that, you know, we're talking about where, you know, we have this sort of fantastical, you know, reduction to, you know, turning the Valley into this sort of virtually car-free place. But there are areas for potential gains. I mean, one of the things that I think Bill mentioned earlier was, noticing these sort of solar farms popping up everywhere, right? So, you know, some of what needs to happen is identifying some of the areas of industrial infrastructure where we could go more electric with transportation, and trying to put in place some subsidies and rebates and support system to try to create some of that, right? So, you know, if we can start to find ways to have agricultural vehicles be more electric, tie into the solar grids that we're creating to be able to make better use of electricity by making it more cost efficient to convert over. A major sort of trucking, you know, that goes up and down the Valley, if we can begin to try to find ways to push that in a direction that you know, I mean, those technologies aren't around the corner tomorrow. But if that's, you know, that's the direction that money could go to begin to push us in the direction of lower sort of, you know, fossil fuel emissions.
Yeah, well, I think one of the problems is maybe a square peg in round hole situation where the Valley really is developed kind of a sprawl suburban lifestyle. And a lot of this mass transit stuff really requires more urban density. So it's, you know, can you reshape a community to make mass transit work? Paul, I want to ask you a question. Statewide.
Some of the simple things, Mark, just one other thing to add. Sure. Even some of the things to raise awareness, even if it's not effective, about conservation and air quality, just don't happen here. Bill, how many carpool lanes are there in the city of Fresno now? One?
Oh, yeah, very, very little on 41.
41. I think it's the only place I've ever noticed them in all of the Valley. No carpool lanes.
Okay, Paul, I want to transition the discussion, though, to diesel-powered freight. It emits 45% of the smog-forming pollution in the state. Last summer, Governor Brown issued an executive order directing state agencies to establish clear targets to transition California's freight system to zero-emission technologies. You know, the Valley is a pretty big logistics center. Lots of trucks going up and down Route 99. Won't that require a pretty radical transformation of California's and the Valley's trucking industry?
The word "radical" is probably understated. It's got to be a total overhaul of the freight fleet in California.
The technology's not here yet. And here's the irony. The total irony is, you know, there was a bill that would allow CNG for trucking, for freight, and the technology's here, and it's considerably cleaner. And yet the environmentalists, you know, their whole pressure on this was, oh, no, you go there, and then you'll never get to electricity. And so we're in a situation in which we're going to be waiting a long time. I mean, I know that BMW and others in Europe are working with electric freight, but the reality of what we haul here in America, I mean, really, we're talking 20 years from now?
Yeah. Well, the one thing they're hoping is that if they adopt this rule, that somehow it's going to force technology to adapt. That remains to be seen. I want to ask you, Bill, let me follow up on a question about AB 32, you know, that famous or infamous law that established greenhouse gas emission targets for 2020. As a result, there's a question about what happens after 2020, because the law was designed to get us to these targets by 2020. It appears there's going to be a need for a two-thirds vote to reauthorize the cap and trade program, which is part of this AB 32 a goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. If you're going to include extend it beyond 2020. Do you think the legislature will extend cap and trade after 2020, or is it the end of the road at 2020?
Well, let's be honest about this. If the Democrats have 2/3 of the legislature in 2020, it'll pass.
But they don't.
Why do they need 2/3? Why do they need 2/3, Mark?
They need 2/3.
Is it a tax question?
Well, that's the question. I mean, there's a question now in terms of litigation whether or not this is actually a tax or a fee, and whether it needs a 2/3 or majority vote.
I thought that's one of the advantages of cap and trade. It's not a tax. They don't need the 2/3.
Well, a court decision came out saying it's a little of both. It's a tax and it's a fee. And so they kind of punted on that issue. But I think if you're going to be safe from a legal standpoint, you're going to want to have the 2/3 vote. And right now, the Democrats don't have that. I guess we're going to see what happens in November. Any thoughts, Professor Monroe, on what we're going to see in November? We're going to see a 2/3 majority in both houses by the Democrats?
I don't think so. My guess is that the Democrats are, sort of near stable state, and maybe even sort of going to stand to lose a couple of seats. So my hunch is that we're going to see majorities that look big, but not super.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank our guests for a rather wide-ranging discussion today on various issues, starting with cap and trade and going all the way to a 2/3 majority in the legislature. I want to thank the Tony Coelho Chair of Public Policy at UC Merced, Professor Nate Monroe, former Visalia Times Delta editorial page editor Paul Hurley, and Fresno Bee editorial page editor Bill McEwen. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
The Matty Report. Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.